Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Dermot Whelan in for Oliver this week. 51551 if you want to get in touch. 087-032-3232. Oliver at rte.ie for emails. Have a listen to this.
Ireland. A small island on the edge of Europe. Between the old world and the new. These seas were not barriers. These were our highways. Charting the ebb and flow of an island people. The landscape itself bears the traces of our history.
Who are the Irish? Where did we come from? Where did we go? Sounds like an existential crisis we're having. But 6 million people lived on the island of Ireland, but over 80 million people worldwide say they are Irish. The whole world turns green on St. Patrick's Day. Why is that? Well, a new series from the award-winning team behind 1916, The Irish Rebellion, is coming to TV screens this week, exploring over 8,000 years of Irish history, from the earliest inhabitants to the latest. And it's narrated by the voice you just heard, the brilliant Colin Farrell. Professor Brianna NicDiarmida, the person behind the show, is in studio with me. Good morning, Brianna. How are you?
Good morning, Dermot. I'm very well indeed, and thank you for having me on.
8,000 years of Irish history into 4 hours. Fair play to you.
Oh, God, don't even talk.
How do you decide what's going to go in and what's not?
Yeah, with great difficulty, I have to say.
Yeah.
It's the simplest answer to that one.
I suspect your original pitch wasn't 4 episodes, but yeah.
No, it wasn't, to be honest. To be fair, it was 6, actually.
Okay, right. Well, even that, that's a tremendous feat. But yeah, it travels right back to the very first inhabitants of Ireland. Who were they?
That's a really good question. And to date, we've archaeologists, I'm not speaking here as an expert myself, but from our conversations with archaeologists and increasingly with geneticists, science has really moved on, Dermot, you know. I mean, I think you mentioned you've got an archaeology degree.
I do. Thank you for making me feel it more relevant.
Well, indeed.
It's not
absolutely
often I get to talk about it.
Everyone should have an archaeology degree. At least some of us certainly should.
Yeah.
But the developments in scientific techniques, you know, being able to extract DNA and now the analysis of ancient DNA, and to be able to extract actually from sediment, not just even from bodies, but from sediment, ancient DNA, can tell us so much more than we ever knew before. So there's always, in that sense, a revision going on as to who the first people were.
Who do we think they were?
So at the moment we start the whole series down in a cave in East Cork with a group of archaeologists.
Yeah, that's a fascinating clip.
It is, and we were down there in that cave, my God.
Scratching
away, trying to find sediment. And what they are, there's a man called Richard Jennings. He's an archaeologist and he's a specialist in the Paleolithic, that's the really earliest times. And he's searching for Neanderthals. He's a specialist in Neanderthals. And of course, we don't have any Irish Neanderthals. But he's convinced that he will find evidence down there of that, which of course will completely revise our whole idea of who the first people to come to Ireland were.
When do we think the first ones were there?
Well, to date, I think the accepted view is that there were hunter-gatherers who came here by boat about 8,000 years ago. And they were here for a couple of thousand years. So we do have evidence of those, archaeological evidence of those of those people. And then they disappeared. And then another group of people came in. And these were our first farmers. And they have left us again. They have left us wonderful evidence. Say, Cage of Fields, for example. Up in the northwest coast, and the wonderful work Seamus Caulfield has done there, you know.
Yeah.
And we were reminded very much of Seamus Heaney's poem Bel Derg, you know, when he talks about the stony soil of Mayo, or the stones of Mayo, and what
they reveal. Hear him reading it in the show. It's quite poignant, actually, and it just the TV program really taps into that mystery of our past, and that's really searching for clues. I think of going up to you know, the Aran Islands. You go up to Dún Laoghaire, and
absolutely,
you're wondering, who were the people who built this phenomenal structure?
This is it, and these incredible structures like Newgrange, and these were our first farmers, you know.
Yeah.
And that Newgrange was built 2,000 years before the pyramids, before Stonehenge. And we're still unravelling. I mean, archaeologists are still unravelling the mysteries there, and they are mysteries.
Yeah.
And the people who built those, then they disappeared into the mists of time, and another group came. And we've got more evidence there because we're now into, say, the Bronze Age.
Yeah. So, well, you mentioned the science and the latest discoveries in science. And there is a really amazing part of the first episode. People don't have to wait long to get to it. But where they found a skeleton, and then they used the latest technology to recreate the face to really bring to life. Tell us about that. This is the Rathlin Man.
Yeah, that was really, I suppose, for me, I love prehistory. I didn't study archaeology, but I'm fascinated by that deep, as people were calling it, the deep past.
Yeah.
You know, how can we know these people from the deep past? And so we came across this wonderful woman up in Belfast in Queens, Eileen Murphy, and she'd been working on a skeleton that had been found in Rathlin Island. In a dig, there was a cist burial, that is to say, a stone burial. And it was in danger of the dunes coming in and destroying it. So a community archaeologist did a dig there and they recovered three skeletons. And one of them, this was the man, this person we're calling Rathlin Man.
Yeah.
And so Eileen's been studying him, or Professor Murphy, I should say, has been studying him over many, many years. And she's an osteoarchaeologist, right? So she studies bones, basically.
Yeah. What's lovely is you get the impression from when you're watching it that she has this real relationship
with
this skeleton, like they're pals.
She's
because they spent so much time together.
Yeah, she's totally wonderful. And she looks at these, she says, you know, it's a skeleton. She says, but it's also a person. Like it's someone's brother, someone's father, because it's a male skeleton. But she can tell things like, for example, that he had wonderful teeth. That he was between 40 and 60, which was quite an age. And he was
5'11". Yeah, because you get the impression that maybe when you look at door frames on cottages from the 19th century,
exactly.
You think we were all tiny, but actually 5'11", that's a good height.
A very good height.
And a very healthy body in terms of
the
time.
Yeah, and she reckoned
that
he would have probably had, given the burials, he was buried in the pot beside him, that he would have been of high status. So, ancient DNA is something, again, that has cast really new light on these people from the deep past. And there are two people in Trinity in particular, two geneticists, Professor Dan Bradley and Dr. Lara Cassidy. And they've been to the fore, really, in developing this whole technique of the analysis of this ancient DNA. So from that, and they studied the DNA of this skeleton from Rathlin, that Professor Murphy, so they were collaborating. So they were able to come up with much more detail as to the skin tone, the eye colour, the hair texture. So using that DNA analysis and using the 3D of the skeleton, 3D photographs taken in the lab in Queens, we were able to commission FaceLab, which is a cutting edge, I mean, really the cutting edge forensic laboratory in Liverpool, John Moores University, to reconstruct the face of this Rathlin Man.
Well, it's a great moment where Professor Murphy herself, who spent so much time with the skeleton, gets to go in and we go with her. And it's the first time that she sees the face of this human that she's been spending so much time with. The general consensus on the team here this morning was that he looks quite like a hipster barista. That if he's knocking around.
Spot on, actually.
Randall, you know, with a rolly in his hand, you'd be like, okay, yeah. But yeah, really interesting. And we were quite dark skinned back then. Our ancestors had darker skin. We associate freckles and all that with Irish skin, but it wasn't always the way.
Yeah, well, this particular individual had lighter skin tone. But and of course, this is a hugely controversial area. I mean, my goodness, you draw everybody out from under stones when you start talking about this stuff.
Really?
But Rathlin Man had, so they were able to prove from this DNA that he was part of a group of people who had come from the, what's known as the Pontic Steppes, basically Russia and Ukraine today. So these people moved after about 4000 BC, they moved across Northern Europe and they ended up on Irish shores.
Yeah.
Like so these were the people they brought with them, we think, a Celtic language. So this individual, they were able to prove that this individual is really one of our genetic ancestors.
Okay.
So he had, you know, reasonably fair skin, brown eyes, although he had the gene for blue eyes as well, but his eyes were brown. But also he was lactose tolerant. Which means he could drink, his diet was primarily milk and dairy. And again, that adds up to evidence of a strong presence of dairying in the country. You know, we should have gone to the dairy board, I think, for sponsorship because, you know, this idea that Ireland
goes right
back to prehistory.
You talk about these big movements of people and you kind of wonder, you know, at one civilization there and then the next minute, in inverted commas, it's gone.
Yeah,
you
that's...
know, we don't really know
don't
what
know.
Causes these big shifts in populations, do we?
We actually don't know at all. Yeah. And it's a big debate among archaeologists, and again, I suppose, with this ancient DNA. So, for example, there was an earlier group of farmers, the very first farmers who came, would have looked quite different, and their DNA was quite different, and they would have had darker skin, more sallow skin, I should say. And when I asked Professor Bradley in Trinity, well, what would these people have looked like? He said, we'll go to Sardinia.
Really?
Yeah. So
there's everybody listening is like, God,
I want to be in Sardinia.
Why can't we get more of those genes? Sallowed skin Irish is something that we love.
Yeah, those genes are gone. They went out
of
history. Now, again, I said we don't know why. But then this new group, I said this there was a 95%, you wouldn't call it displacement, but a change in population.
It could be weather events or many things we
weather
we
events,
don't
could
have
be better technology. Yeah. You know, they had access to horses, for example. So we don't really know. It's very fascinating and interesting.
There are some written accounts you talk about in the show, you know, of early accounts of Irish people, descriptions of people who may have visited, third-hand accounts. The Romans said we were cannibals. Was there any evidence of that? Or is that them just being mean?
Not sure if it's mean, but certainly there's no evidence of that.
Yeah.
It's interesting because the Romans never invaded Ireland in a military sense. We did have contact with the Roman world through trade. But we never had a Roman legion here as they had in Britain, for example. But we would have been back and forth across the Irish Sea. And of course, that's how Patrick came here. But we were talked about in Roman sources and in classical sources. And one famous, or I could say infamous description of the Irish was by a famous geographer called Strabo from Alexandria in the second century. And Strabo talks about this island behind the island, this small little island, Hibernia, and the inhabitants were total barbarians and savages. They were cannibals. They practiced incest. They slept with their mothers and their fathers, etc., etc.
Yeah, well, I studied Greek and Roman archaeology. As far as I can see, the Romans thought everybody was a barbarian.
Absolutely.
If you weren't Roman.
That's exactly it. And this whole thing, he goes on to say, Strabo, because it's really interesting, that actually this description of the Irish that he was so sure about, it's not really based on any evidence, and that nobody he knows has ever been to Ireland. But of course, it's exactly the same way they describe the Scythians, other barbarian races.
Yeah.
As you say, anybody
outside
the empire.
It was basically the ancient Roman equivalent of Reddit.
Absolutely. But you know, the danger
with cannibals.
I think they're cannibals. Yeah. The danger with that, though, is, of course, that idea of the Irish as being these barbarian savages outside the Pale, whatever the Pale might have been, is something that's taken up again and again. You know, it's taken up by Gerald Cambrensis, or Gerald of Wales, who comes over with the Norman invaders. His family are very involved in that very first wave of Norman conquest. He talks about the Irish being cannibals, being savages, being pagans, even though they were Christian. That's taken up again then with the Tudors. It's taken up again then with people like Spencer. And it's exactly the same discourse that the English, by this stage, the English are using to describe the Irish as dogs and grasshoppers and less than human. They use the same thing in the New World. A guy called Gervase Markham, he was a soldier in Ireland and in the colonies in the US. He says, you know, like the savage Indians, the wild Irish live. So there's this equation always of the Irish as being outside the Pale. And of course, that's used to, obviously, to justify colonisation, to justify invasions. And it goes over into India as well, very same discourse.
Where did your own passion for all this history come from?
Since I was a child, I think, probably. I remember I've got a book at home called The Course of Irish History, which started off as a radio, actually, as a radio show on RTE. And then it was published as a big book. And I think my parents gave me that when I was 8.
It's funny how these little moments, these little books that creep in.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, it was Raiders of the Lost Ark. Yeah. That was a pivotal moment. And somebody gave me a birthday present of a book about ancient Egypt.
Well, there you go.
And it just clicked.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? It just ignites something in you. And then I grew up in Wexford, southwest Wexford, around New Ross and southwest Wexford, down, which is now called the Norman Way and all of that. And sure, you couldn't, I mean, we're surrounded by history. All the old Norman abbeys, you know, beside Tintern Abbey, we stood and played down there. Hookhead, the lighthouse. You kind of think, where did that come from? Who built that? All of that stuff, you know. And then 1798, of course. And so history was all around us, all around me when I was growing up. And it's always fascinated me.
And where did your work take you then? Because you've had a few career changes in your life. So you were an academic first, is that right, before you got into broadcasting?
I've had a bit of an ill-spent youth, I suppose, in some ways. Certainly an interesting one.
It sounds like you're curious.
I'm curious, yeah. So I started off, I did a degree in Trinity and did a master's and then did a PhD. Actually, my very first job was with Gaelin, managing the record company. So I had a big interest in music as well. So I didn't last long at that because I thought, oh gosh, I will come to an ill-spent end if I stay going to music festivals for the rest of my life. So I went back then and did my PhD, and then I was in UCD. I was actually in UCD. Then I came to RTE and worked here as for a period. And then I went when TJ Cahir started. I moved west and was working on Ross na Rún. I wrote scripts for Ross na Rún for many years. I was their script editor. I did documentaries. I started making documentaries. And then I missed academia. Then I went back to UL. Then I ended up in the States as a professor in Notre Dame.
What was Notre Dame like? A professor of Irish studies over there?
I was, and a concurrent professor of film and television. It was a very interesting place. It was terrific when I went out there. We had a wonderful team of Irish people there. Brandon O'Buchala, who's very, very good to me in my younger years, acted very much as a mentor to me. He was professor of Irish language and literature. Also, we have Seamus Dean, of course, Declan Kybert, the more laterally, and other people whose names are now probably escaping me. Luke Gibbons, of course. So we had it was a very lively place. You had this cadre of Irish academics, Irish intellectuals, I suppose. Very exciting place.
How do you feel when you hear about what's happening to the American universities at the moment, the pressure they're under? And
it breaks my heart. I mean, I think it's such a frightening thing to be happening. I mean, it really is echoes of the. I mean, people saying, "Oh, it's look at Europe in the 1930s." But I mean, it's more than echoes now. It's exact replica of what happened. You know, who do you come for first? You know, and you come for the most vulnerable, but you also then come for the intellectuals, for people who stand up against you, you know, and that's, I think, people who stand against ignorance, people who stand up for knowledge and for pursuing knowledge, you know, wherever that may take you. It mightn't be comfortable sometimes, you know, but we have to look at ourselves in the most holistic way we can, both in the past and in the present. And I think that's what universities do. They, you know, they make knowledge available for people. And I think an attack on them in this way is just really, really sad, which is the nicest thing I can say about it is that it's sad.
Yeah, well, Harvard seemed to be leading the pushback, so we'll see
on. Yeah, exactly.
We heard the voice of Colin Farrell doing the narration on the TV show. You had Liam Neeson doing your last one. I was saying that you would definitely win the Who's the Most Famous Person in Your Phone competition down the pub. How do you manage to get hold of these? You know, because there's a lot of trust there. They are very cautious people about attaching themselves to things that, you know, they need to be confident in it.
They absolutely are. And look, I've been extremely lucky. I was going to say there's a little secret. It's the second secret of Fatima or something as to how I get these people. But no, in all honesty, it's because they're incredibly generous. They're very proud to be Irish, both of them. And they like my work, thank goodness. So I first pitched this to Coco Television, Linda Cullen and Stuart Switzer. They went, "You're going to do what?" And I said, "Yeah, and you're doing it with me." So, you know, we've had a long standing a relationship with Coco. And so when I went then, when we did 1916 with Colin Farrell, with Liam Neeson, as you said. So then I came on and I thought, God, Colin Farrell would be perfect for this. So we managed to get in touch with Colin Farrell. He looked at 1916. He read the script that I'd written from that small island. And he really liked it. So again, the level of trust is amazing. I mean, I couldn't speak more highly of Colin Farrell and his sister Claudine, who works as his agent, I think. But he's been tremendous. And I think if anybody who heard that clip you've just said, the intimate nature of that VO is really moving. It's really poignant. I mean, he's that extra bit that, you know, hopefully my script is good, but what he does with it is just, it's fantastic.
I think it's interesting that you know, having worked for so many years as you did, writing stories, you know, screenplays and, you know, even your work in drama, I'm sure lends itself to the documentary making, because you are telling a story. You're crafting the story of the Irish.
You totally are.
And you need to keep people with you on that journey.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I think people think, academics are really boring. They're not, actually. They're fascinating and compelling. You do have to edit them in the right way in some instances.
Yeah.
But I was blessed here. We had two wonderful directors working with me, Rachel Moriarty and Peter Murphy. Both have worked in drama as well as documentaries, you know?
Yeah.
So at the fore of our minds was that idea, this has to be compelling. Yeah. We have to tell a story.
People will see that when they watch it. You highlight, obviously, our wonderful moments, the great pivotal moments in our history, but you also highlight maybe the stuff that either we weren't aware of, or maybe there's some shame around it. I was not aware, I have to say, that Dublin was a centre for slavery at one point in our history.
It was the biggest slave trading market in Europe. Now, this was the year of the Vikings, of course, when Dublin was founded as a Viking city. It was an extremely wealthy place, but built on a very, very shameful and dark trade, and that is of slaves. Some of these people were Irish slaves that had been taken in raids. There was one raid in Armagh that netted 800 people. And they were sold. That number, yeah.
So I mean, they literally must have gone in and rounded everybody up. Men, women, children, the whole lot.
They would have left the older people and the younger children. Yeah. But anybody between, say, the ages of 60 and 5 were open game. It also, slaves would have come from other parts of the Viking world, brought to the Dublin market and then traded out to other parts of the Viking world. So, we have to look at that as it's a dark part of our history. And then, of course, the Vikings become the Hiberno Norse. They become Christianized. Mm. And by the year 1200, they're treated exactly the same as the Gaelic Irish by the incoming Normans.
Yeah.
They treat us both the same.
You also look at Cromwell, of course, and the fact that he wrecked all our lovely castles. It really annoys me when I go around to look at castles and there's a big lump gone out of it and you think, I'd love to have seen this before Cromwell got here. He really wrecked the place.
He really did. I mean, it's... Cromwell, he's sometimes the main villain, and he is a terrible a villain is not even the word for him. What Cromwell and his campaign did in Ireland,
there was a maliciousness wasn't it?
It was nothing short of genocide. And Professor O'Shuckrew from Trinity talks about that. He said there's a lot about this campaign that was genocidal. They used hunger, they used forced transportation of people. And I have to say, when we were doing this and we were cutting this, just the relevance of that and the resonances of what's happening in the world today, I mean, it's almost overwhelming.
Yeah.
You know? But we were absolutely, I mean, the native Irish, the Catholic Irish, after Cromwell in the 1650s, were treated abominably. They were transported across the Shannon. Thousands were transported forcibly into what he calls almost reservations, native reservations. Not only that, thousands upon thousands were also rounded up and transported to Barbados to work on the sugar plantations as indentured servants. Now, that it wasn't slavery, because that slavery was a legal term. So if you're a slave, as were the enslaved Africans who had been transported across the Atlantic, your children were also enslaved. With the Irish indentured, that was not the case. If they managed to survive, which many of them didn't, the majority didn't survive because of the atrocious conditions, they were freed after maybe seven years, which is the period of indenture.
You travelled to 17 countries to make this show. and you got to nearly all of them. I mean, out to the West Indies, and you look at how the Irish accents and in the Caribbean developed and all that. I mean, we just don't have enough time with this conversation to go through the Normans and... Guillermo Harry, the man who travelled with Columbus. And some beautiful stories in there. Some messages coming in at 51551 saying, very interesting conversation, says Mary. What was the name of the cave in East Cork?
Castle Pook.
Are people able to go in there?
No, it's not open to the public yet. I'm sure it will be at some stage. It's still actively under excavation.
Someone else, Noreen, says, I beg to differ, Brianna, that we don't have any Neanderthals here in Ireland.
You might have a point, Noreen.
There's a few knocking around, all right. Well, listen, congratulations on the show. As I said, I was lucky enough to be to get a little sneak peek of the series, the first couple of episodes. I can't wait to see the rest of it. I can't wait for everybody to see it. From That Small Island, that's what the show is called. It starts this Sunday, June 8th, on RTE1 TV at 6:30 p.m. Do not miss it. Professor Brianna McDiarmid, thank you so much and congratulations on a great show. 51551 for text, 0870 32 32 32. Oliver at rte.ie is the email. Quick break.